Investment Council. I will call this meeting to order. And I apologize for the delay and the technical difficulties getting started. Quickly before we jump into the first business item, I just want to recognize that it is Treasurer Reed's final meeting with the council and as our treasurer, and thank him for your 8 years of service here at Treasury and wish you well in your continued service to Oregonians as our Secretary of State elect. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
We will move on to review and approval of the minutes. Assuming everyone has had a chance to review.
I'm sure I move approval.
I'll second.
Aye.
Pia Aline, aye.
Aye.
Minutes are aye. Approved. Thank you. Minutes are approved and we'll go to Rex for the committee reports.
All right, short list today. The OST Investment Committee approved the following investments on behalf of OPERF. November 14th, $300 million to Lazard International Quality Growth Equity, $300 million to MFS International Growth Equity. And then on December 2nd, under CIO discretion, $50 million to EQT Co-Invest Platform. No investment activities for the Common School Fund.
With that, I'll invite Mike Mueller up to introduce our guest speaker today, Lewis Sanders.
Sorry about that. I'll start again. Mike Mueller, investment officer at Treasury. I oversee the OPERF Opportunity Portfolio. It's my pleasure to introduce Lou Sanders today. He's the CEO and co-CIO of Sanders Capital. I wouldn't expect any of the current OIC members to know this, but our relationship with Lou spans three decades now. In the mid-90s, we had public equity mandates with Alliance Capital and Sanford Bernstein. In 2000, those firms merged to become what's now known as Alliance Bernstein. And after 30-plus years at Sanford Bernstein, Lou became chairman and CEO of that combined entity and served in that capacity from 2005 to 2008. After leaving Alliance Bernstein in late 2008, he formed Sanders Capital in 2009. Oregon was an early investor with that firm in a product called All Asset Value. It's predominantly focused on public equities, but also, as the name implies, has the ability to invest across asset classes. It's in the portfolio today. Since inception, the performance of that fund has been 11% annually, and we're going on 15 years. As a firm today, Sanders manages approximately $100 billion. So we thought it would be good for the council to hear from Lou, share his thoughts on markets today. He doesn't have any prepared slides, but feel free to ask questions as he goes and certainly when he concludes his remarks. Thank you.
Lou, we'll hand it to you.
And the plan, as Mike described, is for me to share with you a few high-level thoughts on the capital market setting and then take your questions. So the setting has one overarching characteristic: compressed risk premium. Best measured, I think, by high yield bond spreads because it's an entirely objective measure of investor attitudes. And in a word, those attitudes right now are sanguine. We are in the fifth percentile of compression. Just to say, by historical standards, you get paid very little to take on risk. And it's a condition which reaches beyond fixed income. It applies broadly across other asset types and geographies. And it's especially pronounced in U.S. equities, which by almost all measures are richly priced. Driving this compression, predictably, is a widely shared And of course, constructive perspective on economic prospects, especially for the U.S., which has for some time demonstrated a certain resiliency, especially to monetary tightening, with real growth consistently surprising to the upside, even as a moderation of inflation was accomplished. And these trends are now thought likely to be reinforced by the incoming Trump administration, which it promises to a lot of, in quotes, wonderful things. Reduce taxes on income and capital, reduce regulatory constraints on business development, stimulate investment in conventional energy resources, and if you're an optimist, and there are a lot these days, use tariffs as a threat. It's a negotiating tactic to improve terms of trade where trading imbalances are large. In turn, at least theoretically, stimulating more onshoring and perhaps foreign direct investment in the U.S. as well. Now, adding to this U.S. momentum, and this is important, has been an unusual success of a handful of technology-driven companies. These companies are global in scope, but they happen to be domiciled here in the U.S. and trade here in the U.S., the so-called Magnificent Seven, a designation well-earned, as these seven companies collectively have accounted for nearly 50% of the increase in market capitalization of U.S. equities over the last 5 years. Driven, it's important to stress, by a proportional increase in their earnings, their P/E ratios are actually stable. A contribution that's even more striking in 2024, with these seven companies accounting for fully 6 percentage points of the expected 10% gain in earnings for the S&P 500. Now, this factor, more than any other, explains the extraordinary outperformance of U.S. equities versus other equity markets. And it's stunning in magnitude. It's just stunning. Some 800 basis points compounded annually over the last 10 years. 2,000 basis points this year. Indeed, the capitalization of these seven companies, I want to stress, supported by earnings, now equals that of all publicly traded equities in Japan, Hong Kong, Canada, France, the UK, China, and Germany summed together. So can we extrapolate this trend? Well, I'm not going to answer that question, but I will point out that unlike prior such phenomena, the Mag 7 are a set of companies successful for reasons unique to each one, as opposed to sharing some common factor linking them together, as was true, for instance, in the oil bubble of 1980 or the internet bubble of 2000. If there's any link, and I think this is worth thinking about, it's a very general one, a basic one, which speaks to the entrepreneurial and technology landscape in the U.S., which remains demonstrably superior to that of any other part of the developed world. And as such, the U.S. has a disproportionate share of the world's intellectual capital driving business success. It may not have been born here, but it is here. And this competitive advantage appears durable, with China as the only apparent potential challenger, which provides a useful segue into the few exceptions to this setting of optimism and compressed risk premium. And there are two such major exceptions, the EU and China, as regions. Risk premium are high, not in all parts of the capital market, actually not at all in fixed income, but demonstrably in equities and currencies. Now, the EU should come as no surprise. It is now seen as your proverbial basket case, where growth prospects are seriously impaired by a political orientation more interested in regulation and protection than in innovation. A green energy imperative, generating high cost with no visible, certainly no immediate economic benefit, perhaps longer term. A mix of economic output in Germany, the most important EU member by far, skewed to manufacturing and mature industries, and excessively exposed, it so happens, to China's local market and China's export ambitions. A demographic profile which points to no growth in the labor force, with noteworthy declines, actually, in some key countries. And, of course, a tragic ground war in the Ukraine. Quite a mess. Leading to high risk premium for EU-centric businesses, naturally. Banks are perhaps the poster child for this. And by way of comparison, they sell these days for cash yields well into double digits, 12 to 15%. That's twice that of their U.S. counterparts. Turning to China, the high risk premium for equities there also reflects a set of now well-known factors. They actually have little resemblance to that of the EU. The pressure on China stems from, first and foremost, the bursting of the housing bubble in that country, for which new construction is now, not surprisingly, in steep decline. Uneconomic infrastructure investment by local governments, financed with vehicles which in most cases are now technically bankrupt. The unpredictable nature of the Xi administration as it relates to business development, especially among very large and successful private companies. And of course, the growing tension between the U.S. and China in many domains, not the least of which is trade. On that score, with a focus on high technology products. Problematic issues to be sure, but with valuation of equities in both regions now baking in a lot of incentive to wager that these countervailing forces will in time be dealt with. Finally, a few thoughts on the impact of technology in the investment landscape. The key message is to take AI seriously. In our view, this is not a bubble. It is a paradigm shift of great economic import. At a high level, it makes knowledge available at any level of depth in any discipline with simple natural language prompts, the goal of which is to inform, to evaluate, or to take action as may be appropriate. It is the ultimate in democratization of knowledge and know-how. Its greatest effect in the early going is going to be in computer coding, for which stunning gains in productivity are already being realized. In and of itself, of great significance, given the central role software already plays in business and in our personal lives. It's a really big deal, and it needs to be incorporated into any economic or capital market forecast, especially those directed at equity portfolios. So that completes what I had to share with you. Now I'm happy to take your questions. Still have everybody?
I think so.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Good. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Well, thank you. That was very informative and a lot to digest here as we formulate our questions. I first want to make sure that I don't forget the folks online and give them an opportunity. Pia and Aline, questions?
Chair, I'm still formulating the question in my head. You go ahead.
Okay, great. Just make sure you maybe raise your hand or do something online so we make sure that we don't miss you.
I will.
Anyone here? Questions?
I can start with one, Madam Chair. And Ms. Sanders, I really appreciate the obvious thought and care you put into your comments. one effect that that has on me is to sort of struggle to think about how to encapsulate a question that, that covers the wide range that, that you do. So the thing that first occurs to me is to wonder how you, in your analysis, distinguish between, I guess you said it to some extent as you commented on AI, what is a bubble and what is more fundamental in terms of change. One of the things that I think, perhaps I'm in more of a reflective mode in my last meeting here, that I think is exceptional about pensions is that we are not short-term investors, unlike so many others. We've got to think about what happens decades into the future and the beneficiaries that we serve. So I wonder, as you analyze the situation in times like this, how do you go about thinking about what's episodic, what is a reflection of a political choice that a country or a region is making versus here's the thing that long-term investors really need to pay attention to?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and I think quite pertinent. As to the characterization of AI, which I describe as substantive as opposed to a bubble, what underlies that, first and foremost, is the speed with which this technology is diffusing. You can't name a major company that doesn't have any number of proof of concept projects underway to see whether or not this technology can be transformative, even at a, you know, at a functional level, but which in some might really make a difference. And I can report to you that while deployment is yet not in grand scale, a lot of these proof of concepts are looking quite promising. And our expectation is that with time and additional development, it is very likely that the productivity gains derived from AI, and there are multiple incarnations of AI, I might add, will be very measurable, will be substantial. There's an inflection here that I think will actually show up in aggregate GDP. I highlighted software because it's clear that so much of business today and our personal lives are based on software. And there we already know AI is transformative. It's not in dispute. It's producing gains of as much as 50% in output for a typical software engineer. And so what you should anticipate from that is not only lower cost to create new functionality, but a lot more functionality per unit of time. And so that ought to translate then to gains in productivity. The second thing to say about this not being a bubble is valuation. It's not excessive. I'll give you some comparisons. So in the internet era, the leading companies, Cisco, EMC, Sun Microsystems, those are a few names that come to mind. They sold at 100 times earnings. The leading company today, at least for the moment, is NVIDIA. It sells at 30, 35 times forward earnings. Its earnings, by the way, if you haven't been watching this, are utterly unprecedented. They have gone from $3 billion of earnings in 2019 to earning this year $100 billion. You can see it has been an element in the Magnificent Seven that have made that group prominent. In fact, interestingly enough, NVIDIA alone is a single company has added 200 basis points to the growth of corporate earnings in the United States in the last 5 years. That one company. So this isn't about some valuation extreme, some fantasy. This is real. Now, I wanted to say, too, that it doesn't mean there won't be volatility. It doesn't. It could well be true that in 2025, as early as then, the rate at which capital is chasing this opportunity proves excessive, that the application suite that I referred to develops, but maybe not in time and with sufficient scale to take up all of the capital / capacity being built today to support these initiatives. And that capacity expansion is absolutely spectacular in scale. Capital spending related to AI will be $250 billion plus in 2025. That's up from $20 billion a few years ago. And to give you a perspective, it's almost as big as IT capital spending was before this happened. So you could easily imagine where it turns out we built too much capacity and there's some interruption in spending, and that leads to lots of volatility in the capital markets. But in time, we're going to need it. And so I think it'll turn out that this is substantive.
Thank you. I will ask a question, just digging a little bit deeper into some of your remarks on the U.S. market and the U.S. economy. I hear you saying that today we're not getting paid much to take on risk, especially in the U.S., but that that is because of a widely shared constructed view on the economic situation here. And that the current trends have been unbelievably resilient, and an incoming president may provide a lot of stimulus, but at what cost, and how might the trends continue to be so resilient if the stimulus provided by an incoming administration continues to drive up our debt here domestically, and how long can consumers keep spending at our current rates? And then I'll just add in a piece on that. You know, with the Magnificent Seven going up as they have, driven by earnings, right, not by PE, would suggest that they're not necessarily overvalued, even though we're not being paid much. But how do we, as we look at your comments, invest on that? Because I might take away from your comments that, well, these seven stocks have driven the majority of the increase in the U.S. In the U.S. equity markets. Therefore, the rest of the bunch is relatively undervalued and is attractive. Or I could say, I'm hearing that these are companies are where the growth is being driven, therefore that they're attractive. And I don't know if either one of those statements is true.
Okay. I'll do my best to try to address what you have just raised. So let's start with the latter half of the question, which has to do with expected return for the U.S. equity asset class. And we'll bifurcate it between the Magnificent Seven and all other. So the way to think about it, the way we do anyway, is that the S&P 493, if you will, is currently selling at 22 times earnings. It's growing at a 3-4% rate, more or less consistent with nominal GDP. Its return on equity is in mid double digits, 14-15%. So to finance its growth rate, it needs to retain about a third of its earnings. Its earnings yield is a little bit less than 5%, high fours, 22 times. And therefore, free cash flow is about 65% of that, because I need to keep a third to finance the growth. So 65% of 4.8, somewhere in the low threes, plus the growth rate, gives me an expected return of 7, maybe 7.5. And if I compare that to the shape and level of the sovereign curve, I get a risk premium for equities, which by historic standards is low. It could stay low. This isn't a prediction that there's some sort of bear market ahead. It merely is an observation that people are very confident and therefore willing to accept less extra return to expose themselves to this asset class as compared to most of history. Most of history is roughly 100 basis points better than this on average. But you know, averages don't have a lot of meaning. You pass through them. You spend a lot of time above them, a lot of time below them. It's not that instructive. So I don't want you to take too much away from this other than to say that you should have sober expectations about what the asset class will likely deliver. And it is vulnerable to some development which generates more anxiety than is currently in place. That describes the 493. Now the seven, they're not a monolith. Each of these companies really are driven by issues that are unique to them, more or less unique to them. I mean, they're all economically sensitive, of course. They're all global. They're all subject to varying degrees of regulatory and litigation risk. But their business fundamentals are really very different. You know, what has Microsoft really got to do with Amazon? Medicine advertising company. What has it got to do with NVIDIA that sells compute infrastructure? They're a customer, actually. So my point is that there's no monolithic one or two common factors that tie these companies together. What's making them function as a group is that they're incredibly successful at the same time and with scale that's spectacular by historical standards, because they're essentially capitalizing on globalization in a way that virtual companies, if you will, can do and physical companies could do, but with much greater effort and lots of capital. So my point is that it's not easy to say that this seven, again, you know, you should safely extrapolate continuing success. I'm not trying to leave you with that view. I'm just simply saying is because they have been, you can now understand why the U.S. looks so much better than everywhere else and why these seven actually have, at least at the moment, higher expected returns. Their P/E ratio is 32 times. Compared again to the 493 at 22 times. So you're paying 10 extra multiple points. The growth rates aren't even close, right? I mean, the historical trailing growth rate for the last 5 years of the seven is 26% compounded against five for the rest. And the forward forecasts are low double digits against four or five. And so it's easy to see that if those forecasts are attained for the next few years, that this trend is going to continue. And the U.S. will keep outperforming, and the U.S. will keep concentrating. And in time, ultimately, it'll mean revert. Something will happen. And my guess is what will actually happen is that there'll be some new guys on the block. And if I had to venture, it will be as a derivative of AI native initiatives that generate completely new streams of value and wealth of huge scale. It could be Anthropic, it could be OpenAI, it could be guys working in the various application layers that come up with some really innovative things that turn out to be widely used, et cetera, et cetera. That's how the world works. And so if you're an optimist, you'd say, you know, you can pretty much extrapolate what you see. Now, the first part of your question, and I'm getting long-winded here, so I apologize. The first part of your question has to do with the durability of the expansion into the U.S. and whether, you know, if you put additional stimulus in it, which in some ways the administration is saying they're going to do, it'll turn out to backfire, maybe because of an accelerated inflation, or which takes the curve and reshapes it, because it's today anticipating additional monetary easing, although not that much anymore. Or you might say that it'll backfire because tariffs will turn out to be counterproductive, turn out to be disruptive. not implemented smartly, but instead in some sort of excessively aggressive way that produces, you know, one of these Smoot-Hartley theories where you get counter reactions by our trading partners. And basically what you do is destroy global trade and depress everybody's results. I mean, it's all of that's possible. I can tell you that none of it's built into stock prices, right? So it's out there as a risk. And you know, so let me cut to the chase and say, the way you deal with this is not think you're going to figure out the right scenario, because you're not likely to. This is not a way to add value, in my judgment. Instead, you respond to a compression of risk premium and uncertainty by diversification, by reducing your beta, by reducing your common factor risks. You're not excessively wagering in the portfolio on any one thing. By having a certain balance in the strategy that neutralizes, for instance, a change in the sovereign curve, level or shape, that neutralizes what might happen to commodity prices, or the pace of economic expansion, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's our response to this setting as an asset manager. I'll stop there because I'm already gone for 3 or 4 minutes on one question.
No, I love it. Any other questions from the council?
I have one question, and it relates to the private equity markets. You know, like other pensions have a large allocation in private equity, we're always focused on liquidity and illiquidity issues that come along with that, and just, you know, how some of your comments you've made to date this morning in, you know, that about more public equity might also pertain to private equity and just a general outlook at this point in time, or any comments about that.
Okay, actually, it's a very interesting topic. So let me start with what I think is really good about it, really good about that asset class. It's that most of innovation that turns out to be really valuable starts there. Now, it always did, but it would come to the public markets relatively quickly, and that no longer is true. Some of the most successful companies stay private. And they do because the capital is available. Actually, valuation is typically higher than that available publicly. And you don't have the burden of being public. And those burdens are obvious and substantial. So what that means as an investor then is if you want to be exposed to a lot of wealth creation, with, of course, the risks associated with venture, you need to be in this space. And the public investor is disadvantaged, doesn't have access, finally gets access in quotes after it's too late. And I just think it's the feature of the way capital markets have evolved. Now, let me give you some negatives. You cited one, which is illiquidity. During the rate regime in the last couple of years, that came to fore, and a lot of people didn't anticipate it. You couldn't monetize some of these tranches, and there were prior commitments, and it created some capital flow issues for some plan sponsors, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that's that big a deal. It's cyclical. What there is to worry about more is the amount of capital that's chasing the asset class. And I would say where this is really excessive is in fixed income. This is sort of magic now, right? That you can create a yield advantage against the sovereign curve that's substantially better than an available and publicly traded credit. And you can do it without undue underwriting risk. The loss content is, if anything, better because you're brilliant. And I think this is going to turn out to be a fool's errand. And there's already a couple trillion dollars tracing this, and, you know, this is in my judgment, is getting overdone. So a lot of smart people here, don't misunderstand. It's just that I think it's getting overcapitalized. So I'd be very cautious about exposure in that part of the private capital market world. And then I'd finally say that when you look at the history of the asset class, you know, it's benefited from two things in the long, long term. The first is financial leverage that was unacknowledged, but was very productive because the returns in the equity asset class have been way better than the cost of debt. So if I use leverage, I could have bought the S&P on leverage. I had done really well. Effectively, that's what a lot of private equity guys actually did. They didn't add a lot of value. They just leveraged. And you got to remember what this did. This whole industry started in the 80s, early 80s. Remember, I'm an old guy. I started in this business in 1968. All right. So as private equity becomes a big deal in the 80s, really late 80s with Milken, et cetera. And think about interest rates where they were. They started at 20 in 1982. They wound up at zero. The stock market went, I think the S&P was 150 at 6,000. This isn't hard math, right? If I leverage equity, I'm going to make a lot of money, right? Then the second thing that made this very attractive to plan sponsors is the marking. It's, you know, the marking is less volatile than reality, less volatile than publicly traded equity, which is entirely objective and indisputable. And so what did I do? I just created a return stream that looks really good with lower volatility, magic, right? High information ratios, and it's attracted all of this money at very high fees. And I think the fees wound up getting financed by financial leverage. So you can see I'm a little bit cynical about the long-term picture here. But at the same time, remember where I started, that much of the wealth I think that will be a derivative of innovation is in the private markets for a lot of its value added. I'll stop there.
Pia, Elaine, questions?
First of all, thank you so much, Lou, for this. This was riveting and just captivating. Thank you for your time. I think most of my questions have been answered around volatility and overvaluation. Maybe just curious, Lou, what are the 1 to 2 systemic risk areas that Sanders Capital is keeping a pulse on or thinking about quite a bit?
Systemic risk. You know, it's interesting. Part of the reason I think there is compressed risk premium is they're not obvious. If there are some black swans, they're really black. So I don't know what they are. If they surface, it'll be the surprise. And you know, occasionally before trouble surfaces, you can see distortions. You'll see, let's say, excess debt against some assets that are overvalued, or you'll see excess consumer spending and or excess capital spending in some important area, and you know there's going to be an adjustment, you know, let's say overbuilding of residential housing in China, you know, debt financed, and you know, obviously it leads to huge headwinds. In the developed world, you just don't see any of this. You don't. If you think about the last cycle, it's very unique. The last cycle was about essentially monetizing through wealth transfers the private sector from the government. Government takes on debt, prints currency, gives it to the private sector, liquefies it, makes it stronger financially. And then the credit risk is in the sovereign. It produced an inflation, but that's gone. So now you have a debt load that you have to finance. This came up in an earlier question I didn't address. I'll address it now. The debt load seems high. It's not actually, because it's growing even with a $2 trillion deficit on a $35 trillion base. It's growing at, call it, 5.5-6%. It's not very different than nominal GDP. It's a little bit faster. It would take a really long time for the debt to grow so much more than GDP that it would be difficult to roll it. In fact, as proof positive, the dollar's at a record high. How could that be if there's some issue here with excess debt creation? So I don't see the systematic threat. And no one does. That's why the risk premium are low. The only thing I can tell you, and this sounds like a hedge, right? But maybe it is that compressed risk premia lead later to a widening of the risk premium. Inevitably, something comes along. You don't know what it is, but it does, right? And it damages your returns because you're going from a narrow spread to a wider spread, and every long duration asset has to be reevaluated in that context. Something someday will come along, and I'm not here to tell you what it is or when it is. I don't really see it. I said the way you can respond to this, you can't respond to it as if you know. What you say is, okay, I know I'm not being paid the typical amount for taking on risk. I'll take less of it. So you handle that in beta exposures and in the degree to which you diversify the portfolio. And the whole key there is low covariance.
Thank you.
Last opportunity for questions here, folks. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Sanders. This has been very informative, and we appreciate your time with us here today, as well as the decades-long partnership that we have had with you.
Well, thank you very much. And I think it's something like 30 years. I was actually trying to go into our records to figure out when this relationship actually began. I think it began in my Bernstein years. I was CEO of Sanford Bernstein.
U.S. Value.
It was in U.S. Value, and then it became international, and I met Jay Fuel, and we did something with AAV, and then Mike and John Hershey, and it's been a wonderful relationship, and hopefully you found it constructive as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for your time here today, and we will, since we finished a few minutes early, take a 5-minute break on our side and be back here online at 10:05.
Bye-bye, all.
Thank you. He's taking advantage of his last meeting. Okay, next order of business on the agenda is the OPERF third quarter performance review, and we have Alan Emkin and Eric Larson from Makita to lead us through it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Council. I want to endorse the Chair's comments, thanking Treasurer Reed for his service. It's been a privilege and an honor to work with you for 8 years. And like the chair, we wish you all the best in your new role. I'm not quite sure how one does the transition from the current role to the new role, but I'm sure you're up to the job. I'll make just a very few introductory statements, and Eric will get into the detail, and I'll make some comments at the end. Not a heck of a lot has changed since the last time we had this comment. Equities continue to do well. Bonds have been more volatile. And the world's still a crazy place. And at the end, I'm going to comment upon the previous speaker's a number of his statements, because I think it would make for an interesting conversation. But I'm going to turn it over to Eric to talk about what happened in the third quarter and periods ending the third quarter.
All right. Thank you, Alan. So as Alan mentioned, I'll provide some comments on third quarter markets. And as the third quarter ended some time ago, I'll also do my best to add a few market updates through the end of November. So looking at the chart on the right, We see that markets rallied in the third quarter and positive returns experienced by all major asset classes listed here. One notable difference compared to what we saw in the first 6 months of the year is a broader spread of positive performance across different asset classes. So contrary to the U.S. large cap growth strength that we saw for the first 6 months of the year, we see the Russell 2000 representing small cap stocks as the second strongest performer for the third quarter. And we also see the emerging markets and MSCI EAFE representing non-U.S. developed stocks also outperforming the U.S. large cap stocks as we see in the S&P 500. REITs also performing very well, returning 16% and leading the way. A more interest rate sensitive assets, so lower rates really helped the REIT performance during the third quarter. Fixed income markets also performing well, both through the Bloomberg aggregate and then also riskier fixed income assets represented by the Bloomberg high yield. And then up towards the top, the emerging markets bonds returning 9% for the quarter. So as I mentioned, the shift here from the dominance of large cap U.S. stocks to a little bit more broader returns. EAFE and or non-U.S. developed and emerging markets benefiting from a somewhat weaker U.S. dollar and some strength in China also supporting the emerging markets returns for the quarter as well. Bond market performance in the U.S. Benefiting from the expectation of future rate cuts and the 50 basis point cut that we did see in September. As an update to this slide, we did see a bit of a reversal in October, asset classes largely negative across the board. Specifically in emerging markets and non-U.S. developed markets, as I mentioned, they benefited from a weaker U.S. dollar in the third quarter. And in October, we saw a reversal of the U.S. dollar start to strengthen. And so that was a headwind to those asset classes as well. Into November, returns were mixed. The U.S. markets responded well to the election. Part of that may be the result of the election, but another part just that the election went relatively smoothly. So U.S. markets responding well to that. The Fed cut another 25 basis points and is expected to cut again in December. So as Alan mentioned, in terms of fundamentals, not a whole lot of change. The U.S. unemployment picture is still roughly the same, and inflation ticked up briefly in October, but not enough to dissuade the Fed from potentially cutting interest rates again in December. So I'm going to wrap my comments there. I'm happy to address any questions, or if Alan has anything to add, please do.
Not on the markets.
Okay. For you. Any questions before I move to performance? All right. So taking a look at the total fund performance for the third quarter, underperforming versus the policy benchmark on both the quarter-to-date and five-year periods. Talk a little bit about what's driving that in a moment. Over the five-year period, outperforming the actuarial rate of 6.9%, and then performance mixed between short-term and longer-term results versus peers. And again, we'll take a look under the hood in a few moments as to what's driving some of that performance. With respect to asset allocation, there is some asset classes out of compliance, as we've discussed in the past, the overweight to private equity largely driving those changes. The Russell overlay does bring our fixed income exposure within the policy range. However, with respect to equities, it actually brings the public equity exposure down as a way to reduce some of the overall portfolio equity exposure that is being taken by the private equity physical exposure. Here, just briefly on this page, we can get, a better visual of the asset allocation and differences on the right-hand side. And then also we do see the shorter-term period underperformance versus the benchmark on the left-hand side, and then smaller but still slightly underperforming over the longer-term periods. A lot of that is being driven by the larger underperformance over recent periods. So in terms of attribution and what's driving those returns, we've discussed this in the past, the private equity allocation, that overweight taking away from the ability to be exposed to more public equities, which, as we just discussed, have had an incredible year. And so that's where you see the green bar towards the top of the page, total public equity as a negative effect. And then with respect to private equity, you know, you don't really see the allocation impact there, but you do see the selection effect. And again, here I'll just highlight the private equity is benchmarked to a public markets benchmark plus a premium. So the Russell 3000, which again, as we discussed, has performed very well this year, plus an additional 300 basis points, is going to outperform most private equity portfolios over the short term.
I can ask a question here.
Please.
You know, I've looked at these slides so many times, and this time I looked at them and said, what's the interaction effect? You know, I'm used to the manager selection, the allocation in my mind. I can divide it into those two. Tell me about the pink there.
Yes. So the interaction effect is going to be the additional effect that comes from being, say, overweight an asset class that also outperforms, or overweight an asset class that also underperforms. So it's combining the two effects. And let me find a better example here. So here, if we look at public equities down towards the middle of the page on the one-year period, we see that the allocation to public equities over the past year has a positive effect. Private equity has a positive effect, but the selection effect is largely negative. And so by being overweight an underperforming asset class, that interaction effect is also impacting those returns.
Okay.
So it is a little confusing, and we go back and forth sometimes on if we can include it or exclude it. But that's what's going on there, is it's an additional effect that combines selection and allocation effect.
Okay. Thank you.
Of course. Okay, so on this slide, again, just highlighting, as we've discussed, the underweight to public equity negatively impacting relative returns, and the selection for private equity also having a negative impact on returns. As I mentioned, we are comparing that to a public markets benchmark, which this year has caused a lot of that dispersion. Before I wrap my comments, I do just want to click through the next few slides of the attribution just to show the theme that we have discussed, you know, sort of persisting throughout each trailing period. We see that negative green bar for public equity, and again, private equity underperforming, with that blue bar being the largest driver of benchmark relative returns. The one thing that is interesting to point out that starts here on 1 year, we see, you know, the overweight to private equity with respect to the asset class is still having a positive allocation effect. But I think it's important to think about it comparing that positive green bar to the negative green bar for public equity, because that's what we're giving up because of that overweight. So, you know, it is a positive impact on the asset class specific level, but if you compare those two green bars, you can see that the negative public equity bar is still slightly larger, and this persists again throughout each trailing period. And the last thing I want to highlight is just compared to peers. Again, we see over longer trailing periods, peer comparisons are strong. The longer-term impact of the private equity allocation has been beneficial. Over the shorter term, we see the largely negative impact of that compared to peers and the benchmark. And then I'll just end on this last slide to just sort of visualize when we talk about compared to peers on a return level, this is compared to peers on the asset allocation level. And you can see that with respect to this universe, public assets on the left two bars, the total fund sits down towards the bottom compared to peers. And then alternatives, which captures the private equity exposure, you know, sitting at the top of that peer group. Happy to address any questions or pass it to Alan if he has some additional comments.
Just to make sure I understand that correctly, total equity is just total public equity.
Yes.
And the alternatives includes private equity.
Correct.
Just a couple of observations. The first is that you are long-term investors, and that as hard as it is to not focus on the short term, you're, as an institution, are going to be around as for all intents and purposes of perpetuity. And over all long periods of time, exposure to growth, whether it's public or private, has proven to be the right way to see a large institutional portfolio grow to meet long-term obligations. So that really says, forgetting the fact that we've gone through an extraordinary period where public markets have so dramatically outperformed private markets, the bet is the right bet, and the decision to allocate is the right one. It's just been a truly extraordinary period. Mr. Sanders was brilliant in so many ways and insightful in so many ways. But his focus on low risk compression, I think, is very, very important, because at some point that will end. We don't know when and we don't know why, but it will end. And the only protection is to be diversified. Your level of diversification can only change at the margins. There's very little you can do with this portfolio other than to recognize it's there for the long term, and it will go through periods of volatility. And for the audience, particularly volatility, we don't care about upside volatility. What we really care about is the downside volatility. People in the investment industry love to talk about risk as standard deviation. That's not how normal people look at risk. Risk is losing money. At some point, the extraordinary returns we've gotten from particularly the equity, domestic equity market, that can't continue. It can't go to the moon. So it's just to recognize that you, your successor, at some point, we will deal with giving some of the extraordinary gains back. And at that point, in fact, I believe your private market exposure will be an anchor to windward, not only because of valuation, but because the valuations haven't really reflected what's happened in the economy at large. So it will be a great advantage. But in the near term, it's been a disadvantage. And there's no way to get around that. And Eric's comments were right on point. When we look at this, we try to say, what can go wrong? Well, I think there's so many things right now that can go wrong, I've lost track of them. But somehow or other, over the long term, capitalism works. It leaves some terrible, terrible damage along the way, but there is no better system. We have efficient markets, capital flows, and as long as that continues, I think it will all work out. But we're going to go through a period of enormous uncertainty, domestically, internationally, geopolitically. There's so many things that are going on. It's hard to keep track of. But you are a long-term investor. You got to stick to your guns. Even if you wanted to move quickly, you don't have the tools to do that in a cost-efficient and thoughtful manner. Happy to answer any questions you might have with that, you know, not so happy news.
And I'll just add to Alan's comments, and this is in the book on page 54, but I'll just read these numbers off. Alan talked about looking at volatility as and risk as losing money. So if we look at the 2023, so last year's return of the private equity portfolio, up 6.4% versus that public market benchmark plus a premium of 24%. So underperformance there. But in 2022, when we experienced that large negative market, that private equity portfolio was up 1.2%, while that benchmark was down around 15%. So just highlighting a near-term example of where that plays out, and remembering that it was not too long ago this had the total fund ranking number one compared to peers. So.
Any questions, Pia, Elaine?
Chair, no questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Alan and Eric. And we will move right into our next agenda item, which is a review of our internal fixed income portfolios with Amy. And this is Amy's, is it your first time presenting at the OIC or second?
Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Okay. Well, good morning, Chair Samples, members of the board. For the record, my name is Amy Xiang, and I'm the Senior Investment Officer of Fixed Income. Today, I will be presenting our 2024 annual review of the internally managed fixed income portfolio. As a reminder, per INV 402, the objective of the internally managed fixed income portfolio is to achieve a stable and predictable yield with capital preservation while providing liquidity to meet agency-related cash flow needs. As of September 30th, the internally managed fixed income pool was approximately $40 billion, comprised of $7.7 billion of government fund that sits within the OPER fixed income portfolio, an additional $33 billion we manage separately from OPERF. OIC has oversight over all of our internally managed funds. Our team consists of seven investment professionals, and we have an average of over 20 years of experience within fixed income. I serve as team lead and oversee the management of the team, our internal portfolios, and the OPERF fixed income portfolio. The Oregon Short-Term Fund is managed by Perrin Lim and Will Hampson with support from Tan Gao, Andrew Kutu, and Patrick Deptula. John Lukehouse and Will Hampson are responsible for the Oregon Intermediate Term Portfolio, the Public University Fund Core Bond, and the Government Portfolio. Breaking down the $40 billion of internally managed assets, a big chunk of it is the Oregon Short-Term Fund. As of 9/30, it was approximately $32 billion. Investors in the fund include local government, state agencies, the state itself, and OPERF. The $7.7 billion government fund is part of the $17 billion OPERF fixed income pool. That portfolio is benchmarked to the Bloomberg Treasury Index. We have two funds that are total return funds, the Oregon Intermediate Term Pool, also known as OITIP, and the Public University Fund Core Bond, also known as PUF. OITIP is a vehicle state agencies can use, and PUF is specific for university systems. The next few slides will cover each portfolio in detail. We'll start with the Oregon Short-Term Fund. As mentioned earlier, it is currently, as of 9/30, it's at $32 billion. This fund is big with cash flows in and out that are between $200 million and upwards of $1 billion daily that we trade internally. OSTF's objective is capital preservation, liquidity, and earning an interest rate in line with money markets. The paid rate on the fund as of October 23rd was 5% and accrues daily and is paid monthly to investors. The duration of the fund is 0.23 years. In terms of coupon type, over 54% is floating rate. The fund is extremely high quality with an average credit quality of AA. While the total return performance for the fund has been strong, that is not the objective of the fund. As I mentioned earlier, first and foremost is the preservation of principal, where we don't lose money. Liquidity is second, where we pay without asking questions, and then third will be yield. Sorry, I don't have my glasses on, so I'm screeching a little bit. The $7.7 billion government portfolio sits within the overall OPER fixed income allocation. This portfolio was created to offer additional diversification benefits to the risk assets within OPERF and provide a reliable source of liquidity. As such, we manage it very tightly to the Bloomberg Treasury Index, as illustrated by the key rate duration chart in the middle of this page. As of September 30th, the yield was 3.8% and the duration was around 6 years. I will now cover our two total return portfolios that are managed side by side. The Oregon Intermediate Term Pool is a vehicle for state agencies to invest in fixed income over a longer time horizon. The objective is to maximize total return within set parameters. It is benchmarked against the Bloomberg U.S. Intermediate Government Credit Index. This is an actively managed pool of assets. The portfolio's objective is to outperform, and it has done so consistently over time. As of September 30th, the duration was 3.8 years with a yield to maturity of 4.3%. Like OSTF, it also has a high credit quality, currently sitting at AA-. And finally, the Oregon Public University Fund runs alongside OITIP with a similar objective of maximizing total return within the same risk parameters. The fund is also benchmarked to the Bloomberg U.S. Intermediate Government Credit Index. Performance has also been consistent over time. As of September 30th, the fund has a duration posture of 3.7 years with yield to maturity at 4.3%. Performance and fund characteristic variances between OITIP and PUF are due to inflows and outflows that resulted with slight differences in the portfolios. Since they are managed the same way, any differences that will resolve over time. This concludes my prepared remarks. I'm open for questions.
Thank you. I have a question going back to the OPERF slide.
OPERF slide.
We're 99% treasuries.
The government portfolio?
Yes.
Okay.
What is the point of having 1% government-related? It feels like it's not enough to move the needle, but it's enough to provide hassle and work. The sector's 99%.
Yes. I will have to ask my team and come back to you with that.
Yeah, it's not super important. I just wondered what that was or why. So then the other thing that I will ask is if the yield to maturity or the total return over time.
For the government portfolio?
Well, for all of them. It's obviously we're getting a higher return for the OITIP. For the total return funds, they're getting a higher return than the Oregon short-term fund. And the average credit quality is not that different. And they haven't lost money. So I guess my question is it too much excess risk for the Oregon short-term fund to take on a little lower credit quality for the excess return, to get a little bit of excess return?
Well,
like these other funds are doing.
The objective of the Oregon Short-Term Fund is not to maximize total return. It really is to provide yield, book yield that's consistent with what's in the marketplace.
Yeah.
So while the return looks good, I would not focus on that. Rather, I would focus on what is the current paid rate.
Yeah.
And if that's something that is attractive relative to what's in the marketplace. So I know I mentioned the paid rate as of October 23rd is 5%. We've had to move that number down because of what's happening with the Fed decisions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the latest paid rate is actually 4.85%, and I anticipate that number could potentially come down further as the Fed continues to drop the rates. The investors that go into the short-term fund, they're really looking for to earn a yield and be able to pull their money out at any point that they can.
I'm just looking at the wrong – or not looking at – I'm thinking about the wrong number. Yeah, that makes sense. Any other questions for Amy? The internally managed portfolios have done a great job for – for the state agencies, as well as for OPERF. So thank you.
Thank you so much for your time and taking it easy on me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Next item on the agenda, and we are running ahead of schedule for those following the agenda and the clock, is a discussion of our securities lending program with Louise Howard, Director of Capital Markets, and Mika Malone from Makita.
Okay, it is now. Now it's on. All right, great. All right, so Chair Samples, Council members, good morning, to be formal. And again, you know who I am, Louise Howard, Director of Capital Markets. Thank you for that. So we wanted to spend a bit of time on securities lending because it just operates quietly in the background, and it's utilized by capital market investors, which allows us as asset owners to earn incremental income for the securities that we hold. But it's a program that's not without risk. So we thought before we would discuss our program in particular that we'd allow Makita to provide a bit of education on securities lending. We believe the last time we spoke about the program was 2020, so it'll be good to have a refresher and update. So Mika will discuss the mechanics, how income is generated, and how risks are mitigated. So.
Thanks, Louise. Mika Malone with Makita for the record. So we'll just go through it. It's a relatively brief presentation. And this is one of those, as Louise mentioned, one of those topics that kind of in the back of all of our minds, but maybe we don't get the chance to discuss publicly all that often. So please feel free to stop me. I'll do my best to answer questions as we go. And then Louise will get to walk through more of the specifics around your program and income generated from that program over the years. So on page two, just highlighting, you know, why investors like OPERF and other funds utilize securities lending. Generally, the goal here is to modestly generate some revenue within your stock and bond programs for investment. It has historically been viewed as a very low risk thing to participate in. We all learned in 2008 that it was not without risk. And so it's important. And that's one of the things we wanted to highlight today is just because it's a low risk certainly doesn't mean that there is not some risk embedded in a securities lending program. So we'll just kind of speak to what those risks look like, how they're mitigated, and just how the whole process unfolds with the different parties. I also want to apologize as we head into this document. There are a lot of different words for the different parties involved, and we refer to them in several different ways throughout the presentation. So I'll try to provide a little bit of a key on the picture on this next slide to help you translate some of what we're speaking about. I kind of like the little Lego-like people on this page in the graphic, but I wanted to highlight that what we're trying to show is this process of a lender providing securities through a lending agent to a borrower But then right in the top bullet point on this page, we refer to an investor. So who's the investor? So the investor is the borrower. So if you're thinking about the folks, these are tend to be asset managers, mostly hedge funds who are utilizing those securities on the side of receiving what is being lent out. You, OPERF, is the lender. So this is the group that's providing those securities. So Luis and her team have a large portfolio of separately managed accounts. They are housed at the custodian bank. So in this case, the lending agent in the center is the custodian bank relationship. And that is who provides both the collateral pool that's invested in by the collateral that you that's held. And they provide kind of the go-between for the lender and the borrower in these circumstances. So lots of different moving pieces. But I think that what is important to know is that anything that is lent out through your program is what's considered fully collateralized. And we'll go through in a couple of slides sort of what that means percentage-wise, but each of these programs has different structures around it, what's allowed to be in the collateral pool. That's one of the things that's been reviewed by your staff as well. And I would say that securities lending programs are quite common in the industry, certainly among larger investors such as a fund like OPERF. They also are embedded. One thing I did want to note that we're not speaking to today directly, but you should also know that many, many of the mutual funds that are out there and places like Vanguard or Fidelity within their index funds also have securities lending as a part of those programs. So this program that we're speaking to today is a direct securities lending program where you're generating income for OPERF, but there's also securities lending embedded into general market products that sometimes may not be as obvious. Okay, so when taking a look at the mechanics, so basically you have shares out of those separate account portfolios. They're loaned out to approved, and again, now we're using the word broker-dealer, so this goes back to that borrower, which is the investor, which is typically a hedge fund or asset manager. Those are the folks who are receiving the shares loaned out, and then collaterals posted as insurance against default. So cash collateralization tends to range from about 102 to 105%, again, always fully collateralized. Note that those collateral pools tend to be in very secure, short-term types of securities, fixed income, cash, but there is the opportunity in some cases to use some equity for collateral or other items as well. So those amounts can vary a little bit depending on what the collateral pool itself looks like. When you look down through, how can you provide some risk controls to ensure that OPERF's assets are safe when they're being lent out? Basically, everything is marked to market at the end of each day. And so if that collateral starts to move below the threshold that's required, new collateral would need to be posted pretty immediately in order to make up for that and to get back to that 102 to 105% collateral range. And on the other side, if the collateral has increased, it will be returned to the borrower if you've exceeded that price. So this is how the various parties are kind of both making money in the securities lending structure and also insuring. And again, this is where State Street kind of comes into play as the lending agent. They're paying rebates back to those investors and then also providing you a share of the earnings from the collateral that's invested as well. If you go to page 5, sorry, I also don't have my glasses on like Amy, so I like to see it closer to me. What happens with the lending agent? So with State Street in this case and OPERF, there is a split. And so you as the lender of the assets and then the securities lending agent sort of split the profits that are made by the collateral pool that's invested in the securities that you have lent out. And that range is very broad across the markets. It has everything to do from the type of securities that you're lending out, the length of the program that you've been providing, just general marketplace dynamics. Over time, and particularly since the end of the global financial crisis, that split has shifted in favor of the folks lending assets. And so where it used to be in the beginning of my career, it was often a 50-50 split. That has shifted much more towards folks like OPERF receiving a larger share of the profits. One thing I did want to note, though, and this is important just to be aware of, when we think of kind of the big picture of securities lending, you're splitting the profits, but the risk is really entirely with you. And that's part of how these things have shifted over time as the investors after investors and lenders after the global financial crisis, when some of these collateral pools had some counterparty risk that was embedded and had other assets be kind of stranded in these pools for a period of time. I think a lot of the lenders out there said, hey, all this risk is with us. Now we're the ones who have assets that we can't get back. Off loan, Lehman Brothers was a counterparty in many of these programs for years. That created some marketplace issues. So I think that rightfully the shift has now moved to say you are taking more of the risk as the lender of securities, and so you should be receiving more as well. You can see some kind of typical returns in the center of the page here. I would use these as just general ballpark figures. It's going to depend, again, what demand looks like and how these securities are being used. But certainly, we tend to think of things like small cap stocks as being more valuable as assets to lend out. So you tend to see a higher return on things like small cap. Fixed income can vary a lot, again, depending on what the marketplace looks like. The risks, which I noted a little bit on the last slide, are just detailed here, and I won't go through all of them in detail, but I think some of them are more obvious. So counterparty risk, you know, if you do not receive your securities back, collateral would be forfeit, but again, this can create other knock-on effects within a portfolio, so it's something to be aware of. There are a variety of mitigation strategies employed by State Street and other securities lending providers. There's also operational risk. So if insufficient collateral is in place at the moment of some issue with a counterparty or with another part of the program, you need the oversight there to ensure that these things are managed appropriately. Collateral risk, this is that your collateral value is dropping. There could be a default in a fixed income security within the portfolio. Credit spreads could widen out. Interest rates can shift. All of these things need to be monitored and managed on a very regular basis. Again, I think, you know, the marketplace, one of the benefits of having gone through an experience like 2008 is a lot more controls in place to ensure that these things are limited as much as possible. Liquidity risk is also there, and again, tends to be related to, I think, some of the counterparty risks and other risks on this page. And then finally, you can have transaction risk. So one of the things that can come up is if a loaned security, you have a delay in execution or settlement, this can cause a challenge. One other small thing, and I think we note it on one of the pages here, just to be aware of is when a security is on loan, you can't, but OPERF or whoever the lender of that security is, you don't have the ability to vote proxies while it's lent out. So it's maybe not listed here as a risk, but it's something to be aware of. It's often something managed very carefully by securities lending providers to note, and if any of your asset managers have a security that a shareholder meeting is upcoming or there's an important proxy issue to take place, a lot of times you'll pull back that security specifically to be able to vote. So wanted to highlight that as well. I wanted to just note on 7, we highlighted some of the risk mitigants, but ultimately you can't fully eliminate investment risk, right? That's true for a securities lending program. It's true for all investments in a portfolio. There have been losses in collateral pool investments over the years. Several different things can create those losses. It's something to be aware of anytime you're looking at a program, utilizing one of these programs. I will note that the marketplace today, because interest rates have come up over the last couple of years and because demand in the marketplace has increased as well for securities, I would say Makita generally views today as a somewhat more favorable time for securities lending than some periods in the past. But again, there could be other risks out there. The risk of default in fixed income instruments has certainly increased as well. So each of these things has to be weighed when employing these programs. I'm going to just skip to the conclusion to note that it's probably obvious why groups like OPERF participate in securities lending. You can generate modest revenue. Typically, the potential for securities being lost or liabilities owed is small and can be managed. partnering with the right type of group is important. State Street is a very large provider of securities lending to its clients. And so I think there's some name recognition attached to that. And then at the end, I think taking a look at programs like this, refreshing all of our memories in terms of what a securities lending program looks like, and then reviewing the program itself on a regular basis is another way to mitigate the risks in the portfolio.
So I understand from the lender's standpoint, kind of getting the extra yield in some way through this program. From the borrower's standpoint, they're the ones establishing, really putting cash into the collateral pool, right? So in effect, buying the security, even though they don't really buy the security, they're buying into the pool. In some way, are they buying? So that's one question. Are they, because the security stays on your books and then is accounted for as being lent out, really on a balance sheet perspective. So I don't quite understand from the borrower's standpoint, if they have excess cash, and this is cash that they would otherwise invest as just cash, and this probably has some liquidity considerations too, are the yields that much higher that they can earn in really their investing in, the collateral pool? How am I not thinking about
this? They're shorting the stock. So they're selling the stock, but they don't own it. So they're borrowing it from you.
Okay.
So that they can sell it.
Okay. And that's how they're...
Because they think it's going to go down. Okay.
Thank you for that missing piece. I needed that.
They hope that the price will go down by a larger amount than the interest that they're paying on their borrowing. So maybe they're paying 5%, but they think the stock's going to zero.
Okay.
And they will also participate in a bit. There's a rebate that goes back to them within the collateral pool as well. But mostly, I think Chair Samples highlighted the reason that they're borrowing that security.
So then they go back out into the open market and purchase it at a lower price.
Right.
And then return the shares to you.
Okay.
If it's gone down. And if it hasn't, that's when they can.
And am I correct in saying it really stays on our books the whole time?
It does. Yeah. You participate correct.
It's a lie. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. What about dividends? Do you receive the dividends on lent out shares?
I believe you would. Mm-hmm.
You will have record date securities lending where they will borrow with that express purpose.
Yeah.
So if they're the owner of the security on record date, then they would receive it. So again, there are so many different, opportunities for folks on the borrow side for securities lending. And we generally will receive notice from our team if there are any, they call specials, so hard to borrow securities or unique trades that are happening in the market that could impact us. And that will happen from State Street side, or our managers will reach out to us and ask us not to loan certain securities because they know those transactions are happening.
Yeah. And how, and maybe you're going to get to this later, but with the proxy voting, Mika said that oftentimes the program manager will notify the owner, ourselves, of a vote coming up. But does State Street do that? Are we relying on them? Is our engagement team, to the extent that we're engaged in something working, do they go proactively to State Street? Do we work with Glass Lewis? How is that managed?
I will get you a more specific answer because I do not have it, and Philip is traveling. So, so we can come back.
I think Aline, Pia, was somebody chiming in?
Yes. I just – well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Louise, you said something, and hopefully I got it right. You said a unique – I think you used the term unique trade. Can you say more about that? And hopefully I captured it right.
Right, sure. There are certain, I guess, securities that might be considered hard to borrow if there is M&A activity that's occurring. You will see on the hedge fund side, folks want to benefit from an arbitrage. And in those instances, one side of the transaction might be considered harder to borrow. So that's an opportunity if we wanted to participate to earn a bigger spread on that particular security. And in those instances, that's where you would see in the collateral pool, they would generally not be sharing in the earnings on that. For some of the hard to borrows, they actually would need to pay us an additional spread and lose that component of the revenue.
And sometimes there's hard to borrows in small cap stocks where there's a very high short percentage because there's some momentum going on about fraud or whatever it is.
And we saw that with GameStop and some of those small cap names in particular. Okay. Yes.
And maybe there's a large insider owner that will not lend out their shares. So it becomes very hard to borrow because 60% are owned by someone who's not willing to lend. All sorts of weird things happen.
Right. Thank you.
I think so.
Chair, I have a quick question. In preparing for this, I went down the rabbit hole and I found there was a lawsuit led by Iowa's pension fund, and I think there was a consortium of pension funds that filed a lawsuit against a bunch of banks. Could you speak to that and maybe what has transpired since that? I guess it was like 2 years ago, to make sure that as a fund we are protected as part of this securities lending. Do you know what I'm talking about, Louise and Mika?
I don't, and I think it would depend on what type of securities lending program is established, because in our case, our custodian is our agent lender, but you can also have a securities lending provider outside of the custodian. So I'm going to have to go down that rabbit hole to refresh myself and speak to the team to get a bit more color on that. Would not have it for you at this moment.
Yeah. And Aline, similarly, I don't think that I have enough of the details to be able to speak to that lawsuit right now. I would want to look it up and be able to respond in the future.
Fair. Thank you.
Funding is fun. So, all right. And more on our program. Our policy, INV 216, governs the program. And as I mentioned, State Street is our agent lender with the goal of adding incremental income to our portfolios. And we've listed all of the individual entities that participate in securities lending. Obviously, OPERF and the short-term fund are the largest in terms of the percentage of lendable assets across the 11 portfolios. And we're talking about $54 billion in average that would be available, some portion of that to lend. And our program has a long history. It began in 1997, and we've generated close to $450 million over that time period. And also along the timeline, we made guideline changes in 2014 in a post-GFC world that made our program a bit more conservative and resulted in lower utilization of the program. Currently, our utilization is in single digits compared to double digits for our peers. And that utilization number tends to bounce around depending upon market volatility and demand. And we look at that demand across regions and asset classes. Thanks for changing it. And based on our, we have quarterly calls with State Street to review the program, and we, you know, they provide us with peer analysis. We want to always make sure that we aren't outside of, you know, that we aren't taking undue risk within the portfolio. We recently recommended updating our guidelines to harmonize our approved borrower list between OPERF and OSTF, and then to allow the program greater flexibility by bringing our guidelines in line with peers. So we have, and this is just one example, we have a hard cap on for the borrower limit of 20%. And what that has done in our program is once we reach 20%, State Street recalls securities. So it creates additional transactions, and it's just, it tends to be more reactive. So we have, we've softened that language in the recommendation that we made to the CIO. And part of our diligence work is to review the collateral portfolio and look at the makeup of borrowers to make sure that we aren't, you know, overweighting one particular or favoring one borrower. And we, when we do that, we look at our portfolio and then we look at a rotating group of peers to make sure that there isn't anything that looks like an outlier in our program. On our calls, you know, we discuss market dynamics, the drivers of income. I included, just so you could see, we get a pretty, this is just one exhibit from a prior year, and it looks at our top performers period over period to see where the income is being generated. Our portfolio, our program tends to be much, so we generally don't see concentrations unless we have had a significant uptick in hard to borrow securities. And then you would see that top 10, be a much more significant, percentage of total earnings in any particular period. And then one other thing that I think that's really important to note is that to date, we have not had any losses in our collateral portfolios. So we weathered the GFC and continue to perform well. And the team at State Street, they're quite responsive to ad hoc requests. I mean, I can start my day at 5. I know they're open in Boston, and like pop in a request. And by 8 o'clock, I've got an answer. So they tend to be very, very responsive. If we have significant asset moves, the first thing we do is recall all of the securities for the impacted portfolios to take those out of the lending program to make sure that we aren't, you know, we don't need to recall something quickly or have any, negative impacts. So, again, they're very responsive to us. I mean, the level of information that they can provide us is tremendous, just given their size and scale. So they've been a great partner. And again, concluding, you know, our we believe the program continues to be managed well, and we will be recommending guideline changes as well to the short-term fund board at the first meeting next month. So we can answer any more questions that you might have, and we'll come back with specifics on those 2 points.
I just have one more question. Who on our team manages this, at least manages the relationship with State Street to oversee it?
So that's a combination. I am losing his name. Dave Randall is one of the primaries who works with State Street, and myself, and then one, potentially two other members on the team will be a part of that. And I'm not sure how many folks Dave has on his team that work with the State Street relationship overall, but it's Dave and a cast of thousands.
So it's a significantly through operations,
yes,
as opposed to investments.
Yes.
Yeah, got it. Any other questions about the securities lending for Mika or Louise? Thank you.
Thank you.
Great job.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
This concludes the agenda items that we have. We are finishing quite early relative to the published agenda. We will take a 10-minute break here. I will collect the sign-in sheet, and then we will go after the break into open discussion for the council staff and consultants. And after that time, we will have our public comments. So 10 minutes to get yourselves organized. We will start with the open discussion for the – actually, quickly, we do not have the forward calendar on the agenda, but we'll post that up here. This is always posted online, and one comment I'd like to make is that it is always subject to change, but that hopefully anytime there would be a change, there will be lots of notice. And we will move into the open discussion. This is an opportunity for members of the council, staff, and or consultants to raise questions, issues, topics, things for future agendas. Okay. We will move into public comment section of the agenda. This portion of the agenda provides the public members in attendance the opportunity to address the council. Comments made or topics raised during the public comment period may be added to a future agenda at the discretion of the council. However, no discussion or action can be taken on non-agenda items at this meeting. The public comment period is not an opportunity for open dialogue between attending public members and the council. And due to time constraints and the number of speakers we have today, each individual interested in providing public comment will be allowed 3 minutes. And just please be mindful of this. I'll use a timer up here, and I will ask you to stop at the three-minute mark. And prior to addressing the council, please state your name, the business or organization, or yourself that you are representing and the topic that you will be commenting on or addressing for the record. I'll have three people get queued up just in the interest of time, and we will start with Sue Palmatier, Jennifer Schramm, and I apologize. I think it is Aaron Schlenz, but I'm not sure about the handwriting. Take it away, Sue.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sue Palmater, co-leader of the Divest Oregon Coalition. Since this is the last meeting of the OIC before Treasurer Reed heads over to his new job, Divest Oregon would like to publicly thank Treasurer Reed and his Chief of Staff, Dimitri Palmatier, for their efforts to put forward a net zero plan. There are many notable portions to highlight. The net zero plan brings the Oregon Treasury in line with other Oregon state agencies. It details where scope 1 and 2 emissions are located in the entire portfolio, including private investments, a real move forward. Emissions directly relate to those investments that are fossil fuel laden and pose a risk to both the long-term returns and to the climate. Initially, it focuses on thermal coal, oil sands, and frack shale oil and gas, and it commits to no new investments in private funds that are fossil fuel laden. Thank you, Treasurer Reed. We look forward to working with the next treasurer and her staff to implement and strengthen that net zero plan. While we appreciate the treasurer's work, we must also name a serious issue that we are seeing. Over the past 3 years that Divest Oregon campaign has been in existence, we have witnessed noncompliance of OIC policy by Treasury staff regarding asset allocations. let's see, the consequence of not following these asset allocation policies is that there's now a significant illiquidity issue that we've heard about at these OIC meetings that are severely impacting the budgets of Oregon schools. With these ballooning private market fund investments, it appears that we are having some trouble. We mention this because this causes us concern. It appears that staff leadership doesn't what it wants and when it disagrees with OIC and treasurer policies. We fear that the staff may not move forward with those parts of the net zero plan that don't need OIC policy changes because they don't want to. Given the upcoming shifts at the federal level, it is more important than ever that state boards such as this one act with courage and independence for which Oregon has long been noted. We are calling for OIC members to be bold. We ask that you strengthen the Treasurer's Net Zero Plan, that you direct the Treasury staff to implement it, and that you monitor them by demanding timely reporting to be sure they do. For example, we were hoping to hear more about the Makita Aon response to the net zero plan in this meeting and in future meetings, and I don't see it on the agenda. So that's a big disappointment. Time is of the essence. There is a risk to this portfolio. I wish that investor that talked to you earlier would have mentioned that climate is the big risk to this portfolio. It's the big systemic risk. We aim to help in this effort. In the spirits of transparency, Divest Oregon is putting forward the PAWS Act in the 2025 legislative session. It will require a five-year moratorium on investments in private funds that have stated an intention to invest in fossil fuels, a key provision in Treasurer Reed's Net Zero Plan. We will share more details in future meetings. Again, thank you to the Treasurer and to Dimitri Palmateer for their leadership.
Jennifer Schramm for Divest Oregon. At the last OIC meeting, Divest Oregon asked about the vetting of private fund commitments. We were told that vetting does occur over a lengthy period of time, resulting in a lengthy report. We appreciate having received a response. Questions remain. Oregon Statute 293776 requires an examination and audit of investment policies and practices at least once every 4 years. The 2016 audit is a roadmap of problems with Treasury investment practices, including a failure to consistently determine and document its rationale for each investment decision. Risk ranking on this concern is medium high. Risk ranking by the auditor on asset allocation concerns is high. 2016 is the most recent audit, 8 years ago. The public has very limited information about investment choices. A failure to audit compounds the secrecy. The window into the Treasury process was opened a crack by a particular investment that was so troubled it came under public scrutiny. In brief, the Treasury made a $350 million commitment in December 2022 to GIP Fund 5. The following information was available before the Treasury's decision. The fund was dedicated to construction of a liquid natural gas export terminal on the Gulf Coast of Texas, hurricane country. GIP's two previous funds had a history of underperformance. European banks and insurers had withdrawn their support. Litigation about federal permitting was first filed in 2020. Global and community opposition to the project had been publicized. In August 2024, the D.C. Circuit Court halted the project. Why wasn't an enormous decade-long commitment of one-third of $1 billion to a private fund with this sole fossil fuel infrastructure project rejected? Based on these financial concerns and the overallocation to private investments, why hasn't the 2016 audit recommendation for consistent determination and documentation of the rationale for decisions been heeded? Or if it has, how did this fund and its main investment survive the vetting process for financially sound investments? We have heard that Treasury had difficulty hiring a senior auditor, but now that the Treasury is hiring outside auditors to finally perform an audit of investment policies and practices, why didn't the Treasury do that 4 years ago? The public deserves to know.
Thank you for your service.
My name is M. Schlenz. I'm a public educator. I have a letter to read to the Oregon Investment Council Public Employees for Palestine. To the members of the Oregon Investment Council, we come to you today as public employees who are invested in the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, commonly known as PERS. All of us depend upon PERS for our retirement, and all of us are horrified by the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the Israeli occupation of Palestine. As teachers, we see the Israeli military obliterate schools and massacre children. As nurses, we watch American bombs reduce hospitals to rubble, murdering patients and healthcare workers alike. As workers for the city of Portland, we witness how the Zionist occupation degrades municipal infrastructure like roads, water purification systems, and waste treatment facilities, ushering in catastrophic famines, droughts, and public health crises. What is happening in Palestine is an atrocity beyond our ability to adequately express. As our friends in KSO, Jewish Voice for Peace, and the Portland DSA have already made clear to you, a significant portion of our pension fund is invested in companies which profit from, facilitate, or actively participate in the genocide. Over $390 million in public equity investments alone are tied up in companies like Boeing, Elbit Systems, and Caterpillar, which are all complicit in Palestinian death and dispossession. This means that every month, without our consent, money is taken from our paychecks and is used to fund the mass murder of Palestinians. PERS represents our future and the future of those who depend upon us, and we will not sit passively by while that future is built atop a mass grave. My friend Kate Stubblefield will continue this letter shortly. Thank you. Free Palestine.
Thank you. We'll have Kate. And then it looks like Asher Goldman is no longer speaking. The name was crossed out. Okay, so I will, is it Marco Bradley and Olivia Bouchot?
Hi there. My name is Kate. I'm also a public educator. I'm a special education teacher. I'm going to finish the letter that I was reading. Last week, over 50 public employees submitted a letter demanding that the OIC divest our retirement fund from companies complicit in this genocide. As you yourself state in your investment policy document, the OIC's primary objective is to make investments for the sole interest of the participants and beneficiaries of that fund. We are those participants and beneficiaries, and we are telling you that these investments are not in our interest, that we do not consent to them, and that it is your responsibility to us as stakeholders require that you stop funding this genocide. As the OIC is the body in charge of setting investment policies, we demand the following three items. Develop an ESG screening policy for the PERS fund based upon the recent criteria put forward by the Palestinian BDS National Committee on assessing corporate complicity in the genocide and occupation of Palestine. These guidelines, extensively supported by international law, must be applied to all current and future investments in the fund. Provide a timeline by which the OIC will audit current public and private equity investments to determine which fall under the criteria set by the Palestinian BDS National Committee and will therefore be subject to divestment. Provide an explanation for why, up to this point, the OIC has considered it a wise and prudent investment decision to continue putting our money into companies that are aiding and abetting in Israeli genocide and are therefore at risk of persecution under international law. Other large state pension funds, like Norway's KOP, have begun the process of divesting from Israel precisely because it stands as a risky investment. We need to hear the OIC's explanation for their decisions thus far. As public employees, we are the participants and beneficiaries of PERS that you are dedicated to serving. We expect these three demands addressed at your next public session on January 22nd. We await your response. Free Palestine.
My name is Marco. I am a healthcare worker. My money is invested in PERS through OHSU. I find this a very difficult thing, personally, as like I've reflected in my day-to-day work in an emergency room thinking, how would we address or be able to handle the atrocities that are happening here in Oregon? Like, if what is happening in Gaza, Palestine, like, if that was happening here, how would we handle it? And I know from working there, we couldn't. We would be overwhelmed with all of the resources here. And then with that knowledge, knowing that multiple hospitals have been completely destroyed, knowing that mass graves in at least two hospitals have been found, 400 in the Nasser hospital, with some with their hands tied behind their back, knowing that there has been orders in hospitals for the shutting down of a neonatal ICU. You can't do that without expecting the children to die. So I get very emotional about this topic, knowing that my money is ironically going to these acts. I don't know how to express this in ways that would maybe compel action on these topics. Please listen to us. Please adopt a vetting process and a screening process that is in accordance with human rights. Benjamin Netanyahu has had an arrest warrant out issued by the International Court of Justice. Please pull our money away from this genocidal project. Free Palestine.
The Portland chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Per our petition, joined by 847 individuals and 15 organizations, and to comply with international law and Oregon precedent through the Oregon Human Rights and Anti-Genocide Act, that was in 2005, that was passed, we demand the state of Oregon stop violating the human rights of Palestinians through its agents, Treasury. We demand that you fight to discontinue investments in Israel Bonds, Caterpillar Inc., Bank of America, and other complicit companies that are aiding and arming genocide. We also ask that you, like others, develop a human rights screening, a human rights investment policy to prevent these kinds of investments. We join Kali Kassan Solidarity Organization Stop the Plunder campaign to demand that Oregon stop violating the human rights of the Philippines. Our demands do become more urgent with the International Criminal Court's arrest warrant, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But I'm not going to spend time listing evidence of war crimes, climate catastrophe, and genocide, because it's clear to all of us, clear to you. We're asking that you use your power for significant positive change. Don't hide behind what laws or standards that you are or aren't bound by. Because think of what that means. We can aid war crimes. We can create climate catastrophe, mass displacement, just because we're making returns. Are these the Oregon values that we want? As we inch closer to the death stage of capitalism, where the economy as we know it will crumble with the empire, this is all the more reason to invest in systems and economies that the earth, the lives of the most vulnerable, and our very souls can sustain. Finally, we're all here because we've done our research. We know how the great atrocities of history were stopped. Divestment works to make major change. But just don't give away your power. Please own your significant role in this historical moment, history, and please choose to invest in life.
Thank you. I believe it's Nyla Holston. Nikki, that would make sense. Yeah. Isai Aguilar with KSO and Mark Rose. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Nikki. I'm here representing Kalikasan Solidarity Organization, an environmental justice organization fighting in solidarity with environmental and human rights defenders in the Philippines. We are here again today, less than 1 week before International Human Rights Day on December 10th, to update the Council on the human rights situation in the Philippines and to call on members of the Council and our fellow constituents here today to take action to end human rights violations against the people in the Philippines, as well as Filipinos and solidarity activists right here in Oregon. Within the past 2 months, the Philippines has been hit by 6 devastating typhoons, an unprecedented number in such a short amount of time. Nearly 1 million people have lost everything and are internally displaced. Philippine President Marcos Jr. and the Philippine state as a whole have neglected their people during this historic typhoon season, and communities that were already impoverished are now dealing with the compounded impacts of these disasters, including extractive corporations using the disaster as a cover for dumping unknown chemicals into the rushing water, polluting people's homes. The climate crisis is escalating and is already having dire effects on the most vulnerable populations around the world. The Treasury claims that it takes the environmental impacts of its investments seriously, and yet your investments in big mining and oil are directly contributing to the climate crisis and the nightmare it brings to the Filipino people. You continue to invest in companies that violently plunder the rich lands and waters of the Philippines in order to extract resources, making the land and communities less resilient in the face of climate catastrophe, while securing the super profits of monopoly corporations. And when the Filipino people attempt to protect their lands and lives from the aggression of these corporations, they are harassed, surveilled, detained, and murdered by the U.S.-trained, directed, and funded armed forces of the Philippines.
My name is Isai, also with KSO. At this point, we have been coming to the Treasury REIT and the OIC for several years to demand investment of PERS or a PERS fund from companies like plundering the Philippines, companies like JP Morgan Chase, Boeing, Tesla, Ocean Gold, and Teleperformance, whose profits are protected by war crimes and human rights violations, but to no avail. In fact, rather than take our concerns seriously, we have included a picture of our members in your investment report in a section entitled Investing for the Long Term. In the image, we are demanding that you divest from genocide, war crimes, and climate chaos. It's especially insulting in the next context to be included in propaganda that celebrates achieving returns on investments. In the photo, one of our members is wearing a kippah, a symbol of solidarity with Palestine. Is a symbol of Palestine liberation when you refuse constituents' demands to divest. But the new treasurer will listen to the demands rights violations. We met Treasurer Elizabeth Steiner after attending a divestment. She was dismissive. In order to take our demands seriously, we're hoping that the mounting evidence for international human will meet with her desire for proof. She will divest from our public funds. She's plundering the use to have our investments possible war crimes. We have written to her asking for a meeting as soon as she takes office. I hope to hear back from her soon. We will not go away. Solidarity movement is stronger than ever. Portland, Palestine to the Philippines. More and more people are demanding to end the U.S. war on the machine. Please join us. International Human Rights Day, calling on Treasurer-elect us, urging Senator Merkley to condemn the Philippine State and Valley letter. And getting organized to continue building.
Best of luck, Ireland. Well, anyways, I'm actually kind of honored to be here. This is all new to me. My name is Mark Rose. I'm a retired math teacher from Mountford College and Rock Creek. I received hers. I happen to be Jewish, which I think is relevant. I know many people in these organizations. I work with some of them, but I'm not speaking to any of them myself. Everything that people are talking about is connected, right? I mean, climate change, the future, the welfare of our future generations, right? The amount of carbon that's put in the air by war, by the U.S. military, by the Israeli military, right? It doesn't matter whether I am a Zionist, post-Zionist, reluctant Zionist, maybe, whatever. I don't presume to judge some of the actions of my fellow Jews 100 years ago when they were fleeing a burning house in Russia and Europe. But we fell on somebody else. And the problem is we're falling and falling and falling. And all of us feel grief for the Israeli civilians that were killed on October 7th. It was horrible what happened. But I literally almost didn't go 15 seconds without thinking about what's happened in the occupied Palestinian territories since then. Sometimes I'll actually think, how would I feel? What would it be like if a 500-pound bomb made in the U.S. fell on this building right now? And they're actually designed to send out shrapnel. And there's no doubt they're purposely targeting civilians. What they're engaged in is, can be called sociocide. They're engaged in the purposeful dismantling of Palestinian society, both through obliteration in Gaza and through more gradual ethnic cleansing in the West Bank and humiliation and terrorization. Okay? But the point is, all these issues are connected. Many of you probably know that every year, hundreds of journalists, environmental activists, and others are being murdered throughout the world. Many of them are indigenous people that are fighting simply for land sovereignty and control over their own resources. But when there's other resources that people want, like Tesla or other companies in the Philippines, for our so-called green revolution, guess who loses? Right? So these issues are all connected. I think the idea that maybe, well, I have every time, you're working hard to maximize returns for us, and that's appreciated. I've seen a lot of professionalism here, okay? And I have degrees in math and economics, and I had no idea what we were talking about half the time. Okay, so good job, okay? But, you know, if incorporating human rights considerations into divestments is tricky, and it will be, probably because many individual stocks are hidden in index funds and other things, I think if there's a will to do it with all these smart people working together, that I think progress can be made. And if an overall campaign is too difficult, we can follow some of the divestment campaigns on campuses and target specific companies. I know about Elbit. I know something about Boeing. I know something about Caterpillar. Boeing doesn't just make passenger planes, right? They make munition kits that guide those Israeli bombs into mostly living spaces where they think people will be with their families. There are Elbits at the heart of the Israeli military high-tech complex, and Caterpillar's list of uses in destroying homes and neighborhoods and tearing up roads is endless. Thank you for listening. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And our last speaker, we have one more on the docket, Juliet Nolan. No? She had to leave. Okay. And last time I accidentally missed one person, so I just want to make sure that I didn't do that this time. Okay, Liz. Liz, will you state your full name when you get up to the microphone, please?
Yes, Liz Jacobs. JACOBS, which, so thank you for listening. I'm a long-term registered nurse who recently retired. I worked for my nurses union, National Nurses United, for about 25 years. Did a lot of public health work, and I'm here to, as a Jew, to speak obviously about the investments in Israel that our Treasury either is considering or has already invested in. And I don't want to repeat so much of what people have said. There's a genocide, apartheid. As someone who grew up fighting against the Vietnam War and all the other great advocacy things in the 80s and 90s, we saw the women's movement, civil rights. This is for me right now, this is critical, and this is my work, is to ensure that our state does not contribute in any way to the human rights abuses, climate rights abuses. And the most important thing is, the bottom line is that you all have a fiduciary responsibility to Oregon constituents and the PERS specifically. And right now, the Treasury holds about 1.2 million in Israel bonds, earning a pitiful 1%. If that's not a violation of fiduciary responsibility, I'm not sure what is. Locked into it for till 2030. It's a money loser, just like back a few years ago, the investment in Pegasus spyware, which is owned, Israeli-owned company, that there were $230 million, and the thing just went belly up. And I think, again, we were locked into that very, very poor investment. Let's see here. Any investment that supports the state of Israel right now is inherently risky in light of the potential criminal prosecution, international sanctions. I am helping to work with the coalition of some of these folks, DSA and KSO, who are trying to get a human rights bill. Right now it's LC 2037, which is, again, going to really put some muscle into ESG factors in investment decisions. I just wanted to say that, you know, the question is, are ESG investments good returns? Well, studies are showing that they actually are, and they're better because companies that perform well on ESG metrics tend to be better quality than those that don't. Companies that perform poorly also tend to be riskier. And again, looking at the case of the Israeli spyware firm, which Oregon invested $233 million in. I think I'm going to leave it at that to say also that as a proud Jewish person, I am anti-Zionist, and I'm very much not anti-Semitic. I feel that this is my work as a Jew and as someone who cares about this world, especially given what we're looking at into the next years. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your participation and comments. We will adjourn today's meeting, and everyone have a wonderful holiday season and new year, and we will see you in January.